Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Our program tonight is Why Protect Half the Planet and Where to Start, with Cyril Coromos, Executive Director, Wild Heritage, Leila Salazar-Lopez, Executive Director of Amazon Watch, Dominic De La Sala, President and Chief Scientist of the GEOS Institute. And we'll begin with you, Cyril.
Thank you, Anne, and thank you all for coming. Currently Vice President for Policy at the Wild Foundation, but coming soon, Executive Director of Wild Heritage and also co-founder of Intact International Action for Primary Forests, which is a coalition I'll tell you about in a moment. And look at that, we're on the third slide already. So what I'd like to do tonight is to give you a quick overview, sort of the view from 30,000 feet of where we are with global conservation efforts where we want to be and offer some suggestions of how we might get there. So first, the bad news. And, you know, conservationists are always accused of being dismal and depressing. And I'm here to tell you that we're actually hopeless optimists. If we weren't, we would have quit a long time ago. But we do need to be realistic about the size of the problem so that the size of the solution can fit. And that's something that we actually haven't been very good at, and I'll get to that in a minute. But here's a look at a recent article by Pierre Ibish et al. That came out last year or 2 years ago, and that looks at roadless areas around the world. And the big blue blobs are the encouraging hope spots there where there are still roadless areas and where nature seems to be thriving. The red is where you're about a kilometer from a road, and so those are the more developed areas. So that actually suggests that, you know, there's a lot of rock and ice and sand in there, but there's still some big spots of forest. So that's encouraging. And we're talking about terrestrial conservation right now. We're not going to talk about marine. There's not enough time to do both. And if we got that depressing, I think everybody might leave the room. But as encouraging as those blue spots are, there are more roads coming. Just since 2000, there's been 12 million kilometers of new roads, and there's probably about 25 million kilometers estimated coming by mid-century. And the irony here is that this announcement by the G20 to spend trillions on new infrastructure and to put all these new roads in came during the World Parks Congress in Sydney. While all the conservationists were gathered at the World Parks Congress, the G20 was gathered up the coast in Brisbane, and we were talking about saving Mother Earth, and they were talking about $70 trillion in funding for infrastructure. So if you look at habitat fragmentation in forests, and you look not just at roads, but at forest edges, so anything creating a forest edge, so a pipeline, a railway, a clearing from logging, whatever it might be, all of a sudden the picture gets a little bit dicier, and you still see a few big blue blobs in the Amazon and in Central Africa, but precious few other places where that's still the case. So that's a little bit more worrisome. And, you know, what those slides indicate is really what's happening across the planet is very, very fast habitat fragmentation and degradation. So the big picture is that we're facing a wave of industrial development out there, and the results are that we're in the sixth global mass extinction. Populations of wildlife are collapsing. Extinctions are 100 times higher than the background rate in the geological record, so we're in pretty bad shape. And as we degrade habitats, we also cause carbon emissions. So all this degradation is also contributing to climate change. About 10% of the emissions that we emit every year come from deforestation and forest degradation and clearing habitat. So I won't go into any statistics on climate change getting worse. We all know that that's the case. I will throw out one piece of information that you might not be familiar with, which is that from the latest projections, it now looks like we need to be peaking emissions by 2020, bringing them down to zero by mid-century, and then going negative after that, which means absorbing more carbon out of the air through restoration and reforestation. And we need to do all of that within a global carbon budget of about 200 gigatons. That represents about 20 years of emissions. We're putting about 10 gigatons a year up into the atmosphere. So we have a very, very big challenge ahead of us. So in light of that, you know, continuing degradation of habitats, continuing wildlife loss, continuing climate change, what do we really need to do to solve the problem? And it's an interesting question because there's a perception out there that conservation are asking for the whole planet, you know, that we want everything, that we want, you know, a huge amount. But actually, historically, our requests have been quite modest and actually quite inadequate. So the first time that question sort of got posed to the conservation community, how much should we protect, was at the Convention on Biological Diversity in 2004 in Malaysia. You know, we didn't know what to say. So what did we say? Well, we've got about 3% of the planet protected. So let's just triple that. Let's just call it 10%. Completely arbitrary sort of political decision. Let's protect 10% of the planet. By 2010, in Japan, we got a little bit more ambitious. And we said, well, let's bump that up to 17. Let's ask for 25 and hope we get something like 17. And so then the new target in 2010 was 17% of terrestrial area conserved and 10% marine. But that wasn't really based on anything. There's no hard science behind that. And people started asking the question, well, how much do we really need? What's going to stop the biodiversity crisis and what's going to help with climate change? Let me take one step back. The good news, just to give some good news, is that we are making progress towards that 17% target. We're at about 15%, you know, of the planet in protected areas right now. And so there's a chance that we might actually make the 17% target by 2020. Not likely, but possible. And the marine target, we've just about reached. So that's some good news, but it's still not enough. So the question is, how much do we actually need? And there has been a flurry of articles and publications that have come out over the last decade and longer that have tackled this question. And the consensus that has emerged is that we need about, to protect an ecosystem, you need about 30 to 70% of that ecosystem to be intact. And it depends on the ecosystem, and it varies. The Amazon, for example, is about half protected already, but you probably need about 70 or 80% for it to persist. Some ecosystems might be a little bit less, closer to the 30% range, but the average is about 50%. And that's why, there's been a lot of talk now about the need to protect half the planet, and most recently a book by E.O. Wilson called Half Earth, which talks about this issue as well. So the question then comes up, do we have any chance at all at protecting half the planet? Is that a pipe dream, or is there a possibility that we might get there? And we did a study led by Eric Dinnerstein, who used to be at WWF and now at Resolve. And he did an assessment based on ecoregions globally to see which ones might be able to make it to 50%. And the numbers he came up with were that about 12% was already half protected. About 37% could reach half protected based on available habitat. About 27% was somewhere between 20% and 50%, and 24% was in very bad shape. Parking lots in Iowa that will never come back. What those numbers suggested is that, yes, this is a big goal, but it is achievable. It's not something that is completely out of reach. And so, of course, when in doubt, conservationists form coalitions, and we started a coalition called Nature Needs Half, whose objective is really to push for much more ambitious and science-based targets in global conservation fora. So the question is, if we want to protect half the planet, the question is, which half? Well, you know, you can look at this ecoregion by ecoregion, but there are also a couple of other approaches that you can take. One of those is to focus on primary or old-growth forests. And these are forests that haven't been degraded yet, naturally evolving, have all their plant and animal species, and that aren't disturbed by industrial activity. And these are the forests where you get the greatest concentrations of carbon, the greatest concentrations of biodiversity, the highest linguistic and cultural diversity, the purest fresh water, et cetera, et cetera. These are places where ecosystem services are, in a sense, hyper-concentrated. The other point that sort of emerged in recent years is that one of the most effective ways to protect anything is to support indigenous peoples. Their homelands are on a lot of the intact areas left around the planet, and supporting them is a very, very effective way to get those places protected. Here's a quick map of where the big blocks of primary forests are left on the planet. And it looks like a lot, but think of it this way. 30% of Earth's surface is land. We've already lost about a third of the planet's forest, so a third is already gone. About 30% of Earth's surface is currently forest, and only about 30% of that is primary forest or old growth, and we're losing about an area the size of Costa Rica every year and probably a lot more. So again, we formed a coalition. This one's called Intact International Action for Primary Forest. There's about 80 organizations signed on, and we're trying to grow this as quickly as possible. And the idea is to just avoid degrading what's still in good shape. If it's still intact, if it's primary forest, please leave it alone and don't put industrial activity in there. In particular, what we found is that logging has not been sustainable in old-growth forests and is not something that should be used as a means to try to protect them. Last point very quickly is that we know that conservation works, both parks and by indigenous peoples. And this slide is one I like very much. On the left, you see the Caiapó territory in Brazil. That's an area the size of Portugal, about 13 million hectares. On the right here is a slide from the Brazilian Space Agency. You can see that same territory, Caiapó territory, in there. What you can see in the slide on, well, in both slides, is that the area that's actually officially protected is free of fires. You can see fires all along the borders, but not in the indigenous territory or very little. You can see the same thing in this slide here. What's yellow is indigenous territory. What's green is a park. And the fires are, you know, this is not perfect, but the fires tend to be all along the periphery. So we know that conservation works. So the basic message is we need to be much more science-based and much more ambitious about our conservation targets, and we need to be much more strategic about where we start and how we do it. These are two places to start. There are others, but Leila and Dominic will dive much deeper into the details of primary forest conservation in North America and then in the Amazon. This last slide is about the rainbow some positive vibes. I asked the photographer if I could Photoshop a unicorn in, but she said no. It's the best I can do. So, Dominic, over to you. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, we're going to switch gears. Move out of that PowerPoint, and we're going to go to North America next. Okay, thank you. It's so wonderful to be here tonight, and I've been blessed by a career of working in forest now for 30 years around the globe, and so I think I know a little bit about forest, and especially in the temperate and boreal systems where I've done most of my work, and I'm going to walk you through why the forests in our region are so critical to protect as part of the overall global Nature Needs Half initiative that Cyril had filled you in on. So a lot of my work is at the interface of science and conservation. And so back a few years ago, I was part of a study that was done out of Griffith University by Brendan Mackey, which was to map a lot of those primary forests that Cyril showed in his slide show, and Cyril was involved in that project as well. We put that together, and it was a science foundation for launching Intact, which is this global initiative that Cyril talked to you about, which is very ambitious and necessary to the planet's survival. In addition, the IBISH study that Cyril showed you of roadless areas was involved in that one too. It was published in Science Magazine, and it was used as a science foundation for launching this road-free initiative that's up and running internationally now. And so I won't talk to you about those initiatives, but instead we're going to focus on two examples in North America that I'm very fond of that have a temperate rainforest component. And I've worked quite a bit in temperate rainforests. You'll hear later about tropical rainforests, but there are actually temperate and boreal rainforests that are also important from a biodiversity standpoint. So why primary forest? is what I'll cover in North America, why they're important to biodiversity, why we need them to save our climate, our water supplies, wildlife and fisheries and economies that are tied to the sustainable use of those forest services, how do intact areas different from fragmented ones in North America? And again, we're focusing on some of my favorite places in North America, the Tongass Rainforest in Southeast Alaska, where I spent many years as a research ecologist before I became a radical conservationist, and in the inland rainforest of British Columbia, where I'm now currently focused as well. You heard from Cyril about what a primary forest is, and rather than get into the different definitions, I'm just going to show you two pictures, and it's going to be so evident what a primary forest is. This is in Alaska. This is on the Tongass Rainforest. On a good day, you can go in here, probably run into a grizzly bear. Maybe you don't want to. Maybe hear a wolf howling in the background, and definitely see some incredible fish, salmon running through the streams there that you could, it's almost like rush hour in San Francisco. They're all kind of backed up against each other. This isn't a primary forest. So the antithesis of that is this. Primary forests are being quickly converted to this kind of landscape, which is depauperate in those wildlife and fish populations. So when we see something like this, nature is in retreat, whether it's global or in the Tongass Rainforest in Alaska, which, by the way, is one of the world's last remaining relatively intact temperate rainforest. From British Columbia up to Southeast Alaska, that rainforest is just extraordinary, intact, except for where you see these cut blocks. And these areas support incredible biodiversity, whether you're looking at the tropics, invertebrates, big cats, amphibians, or you're looking at the temperate and boreal system where you've got ungulates, and you've got those little lichens all the way in the corner there that are the barometers of air quality in our region. When they go away, you start looking for gas masks. And they're incredibly important to the climate. And they, as you heard from Cyril, they store carbon. They're climate sanctuaries. You're looking at a big stick of carbon. This is the planet's air filtration, its lungs, and its water towers. It cools us. It gives us the water supply that we need during the dry summers in our region. This is the coast redwood that you're familiar with in Northern California, which is a primary forest. So you've been through that. I know a lot of people have been to the redwoods. That's a primary forest. They're going quickly. You can see this graph here in yellow, the amount in different regions based on the FAO in 1990 to 2000. And then in red, you can see just about every place on the planet is in decline. There are some places where restoration is bringing back primary forests, but it's very difficult to do. The first rule of restoration is to stop the hemorrhaging. Otherwise, we don't really have a good track record of putting together an old-growth forest. So this is a slide I took while I was flying over the Cascades in Oregon, where I'm from. The top shows a relatively intact landscape. You can see some small clear cuts even in that top one. The bottom is a little further south, which is peppered by clear cuts. So there's a really good example. There's a clear cut example of intact versus fragmented in our region. So the Tongass, again, incredibly important. Alaska's first line of climate defense. It's absorbing most of Alaska's greenhouse gas emissions and storing it long-term in those big trees. In 2009, we were able to convince Secretary Tom Vilsack to take the Tongass message to Copenhagen Climate Summit, where he announced the importance of that rainforest for the U.S. Commitments on climate change. And shortly after, he announced a transition would occur on the Tongass out of old-growth logging, which was great, right? We're on the right path. We're getting out of logging old trees. And again, that's what fragmentation looks like on the Tongass. Here's what we're trying to accomplish. And we have a program up and running on the Tongass that was making some strides, moving the timber industry out of old-growth logging and into a smaller logging footprint using small logs. That's one of the mills we've been working with that are processing small diameter trees down to 3-inch tops. And you can see the product there in the lower right panel. And the question is whether or not industry can make a profit on that. We were well on the path to testing that, and then the funding got pulled when we got a new sheriff in the White House. So we're going to get back on that. We're not giving up, but right now things are going slow, as you can imagine. So now I'm focused on British Columbia, and it's one of only two areas in the world that has an inland rainforest. This is right at the toe, the slopes of the Rocky Mountains in Canada. It's very unusual because most of the rainforests are coastal. This one is inland, and it's incredibly important, Canada's rainforest. You have a full complement of large carnivores. You can go there and see all black and grizzly bears. You can see big cats, wild salmon populations, and endangered caribou that are associated with those primary and intact rainforests that are going quickly. This slide here shows a satellite image processed of roughly the inland rainforest region, 100 miles going north-south and about 50 miles going east-west. Those little white spots in there are clear cuts. Here's a zoom in of what it looks like while you fly over in a airplane. You can see the extensive damage that's being done outside those green blobs. And this rainforest is incredibly important to Canada's climate and its water supply. These trees can live up to over 2,000 years. They're gigantic and they're going quickly. And the options that Canada faces up in that region right now is to look at these forests as a climate saver, which is the primary intact forest landscapes that I've been talking about, or a global warming polluter. So when these rainforests are cut down, most of that carbon goes upstairs to the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas emission. What we're trying to do, just like in Alaska, is move them into more carbon smart forestry, taking smaller trees, leaving the carbon dense old growth alone, and working on trees that would be harvested by polluting less global warming emissions. So here's my wrap, and then if we have time, I'll show you a slide on road development. But as Cyril pointed out, if we don't get to nature needs half, the future generations on this planet are going to be faced with a lot less choices than what we have today, and difficulty in dealing with the collapse of nature and the incredible accelerated climate change that we're experiencing. Our survival depends on it. Our water quality depends on it. Our climate insurance, our quality of life, subsistence, and biodiversity are all tied to this 50% target. In British Columbia and Alaska, we don't really have the 50% option any longer in some places. We've got to protect all the remaining primary intact forests because there is not 50% left. So we're starting with below that target, as Cyril mentioned, that varies depending on the region you're in. And we've got to move industry into climate smart forestry, which is what you saw in those two examples. So how are we doing on time? Can I show this 3-minute video?
We can do it if you do it fast.
3 minutes. I am lickety-split fast. Yes. And it's a video that was done by Road Free, who's working with Cyril on the Intact Initiative.
Woo!
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Why Protect Half the Planet and Where to Start, with Cyril Cormos, Executive Director of Wild Heritage, Leila Salazar-Lopez, Executive Director of Amazon Watch, and Dominic Della Sala, President and Chief Scientist, Geos Institute. And now we introduce Leila to you and her presentation. Leila?
So good evening, everyone. My name is Leila Salazar-Lopez, and I am the Executive Director of Amazon Watch. I'm also a mother, and I like to say that because I'm doing this for my children and your children and all of our future generations. And I'm a defender of Mother Earth, which is where we live. So I've been traveling to the Amazon rainforest since I was 21 years old, since 1995. So you can guess how old I am. And I was inspired to travel to the Amazon by hearing a presentation at my high school. And that's another reason why I think it's really important to share what we know and share our passions with young people. So hopefully a lot of young people will be listening to this, because it was a presentation at my high school and a slideshow similar to what I'm going to give tonight that inspired me to do everything that I can to protect the world's largest tropical rainforest, the Amazon. So for those of you, has anybody traveled to the Amazon here? Wonderful. The Amazon is the world's largest and most biodiverse tropical rainforest. It covers an area as big as a continental U.S., or as some like to say, if you would look at the face of the moon, that's how big the Amazon rainforest is. It houses a third of the Earth's planet and animal species. It helps regulate our global climate. And actually, the Uwa people that we work with in the cloud forests of Colombia say the Amazon is, yes, the lungs of the Earth, but it is also the heart of the world. And, you know, 20 years ago when we started working with the Uwa people, we said, yeah, we understand that. The Earth is, you know, the Amazon is the lungs and the heart of the world. Global scientists have confirmed that. They've confirmed that the Amazon is like the Earth's heart pump. We need the heart pump of the world to regulate our global climate. Without it, well, we're in trouble. I'm going to turn on this slideshow that's just going to run so you can see beautiful photos of the Amazon. And when I hear you gasp, I know we're getting to the threats. Yes, the Amazon is one of the most precious and sacred ecological systems on our planet. It is also one of the most threatened. It is the home to myriad plant and animal species, but also it's the home to nearly 400 distinct indigenous peoples, groups, and uncontacted peoples. If you could imagine, yes, there are still people on the planet that are uncontacted and choose to be. And many places in the Amazon still are home to uncontacted peoples. And so we work to stop the continued threats. We work to protect the Amazon rainforest by working with indigenous peoples who we believe are the best protectors of the rainforest. If you look at maps of the Amazon, some of the maps that Cyril showed earlier, if you look at the areas that are the greenest areas, the areas that are the best protected, those are indigenous peoples' territories. 90% of deforestation and degradation that occurs in the Amazon is outside of indigenous peoples' territories. So as a very small organization, we focus on supporting Indigenous peoples' rights, their territories, their sacred territories. And I say sacred because this is something that, you know, you all have probably been paying attention to the news and what's happening around oil pipelines and here in the United States around the Dakota Access Pipelines. And what are some of the signs that we've seen, you know, over the last year? If you know one of the signs, you could just say it out. It's one of the slogans of the Standing Rock Direct Dakota Access Pipeline. Water is life. Another one. You got it. You're coming to me with into the Amazon with me next time. Defend the sacred. And that really is at the core of what we are doing. It's defending the sacred territories. And the Indigenous people that we work with truly believe that their territories are sacred. And so, because what, are, you know, for example, the Indigenous people of Sarayaku, the Quechua people of Sarayaku, who are protecting 135,000 hectares, their territory, their recognized territory is 135,000 hectares. It's about 250,000 acres for a small group of people to live on. And earlier today, I was explaining to one of our supporters that Sarayaku, the people of Sarayaku live in a small, live in eight small communities in 135,000 hectares. And then they have another area where they hunt and fish and go on vacation, you know, to the lagoons that are 6 hours down the river in the canoe. And everything else is their sacred territory, is their living forest, is their selva viviente. And this is what they're working to protect. They're working to protect all of Sarayaku, but they're also working to protect the sacred and defend the sacred because those are the places that have the most biodiversity. Those are the places where, as they would say, where the spirits are. And the only place where the spirits are those places that are roadless, that are primary rainforests, that are intangible territories. Those are the only places. And if they were to allow industrial extraction, if they were to allow oil drilling, those spirits would leave. And if those spirits leave, then that forest is gone. So that's, I'm sharing with you some of the cosmovision of some of our partners and why they believe defending the sacred is so important. And so it's not just a, you know, it's not just something that they've made up and it's not just their cosmovision. It is fact of the matter. If you look at the areas that they're protecting, these are the most biodiverse places on the planet. The Western Amazon, the Yasuni National Park, and everything around it, scientists have confirmed that this is the most biologically diverse place on the planet. Yet, it's threatened by extreme extraction. It's threatened by oil drilling. It's threatened by mining. It's threatened by roads. It's threatened by industrial agribusiness. And this is just a microcosm of what is happening all over the Amazon. But the Western Amazon is the most biodiverse, everywhere from the Napo River all the way to the Marañón. It's an area that we call the sacred headwaters. And why do we call it the sacred headwaters? Because it is where the Amazon is born. It's where all of the tributaries to the Amazon begin. It's the tropical Andes. It's where the rivers begin, and then they eventually end up in the prime Amazon River, which goes out to Brazil and out to the Atlantic Ocean. So this area, the southern Colombian Amazon, northern Ecuadorian Amazon, Peruvian Amazon, this area is a special place, which our partners will say is sacred and are working to protect. And that's why we're supporting them in their calls to protect the living forest, to make sure that their sacred forests get recognition as special categories of protection, and within Ecuador, but also internationally. And this is where there is good news. I'm sorry, I almost should stop this. For those of you listening, we're seeing slides of oil, the impacts of oil development in the northern Ecuadorian Amazon, where Texaco, Chevron operated for decades and drilled and dumped and left a legacy of toxic disaster. We call the rainforest Chernobyl because it is in an area of extreme environmental, social, and cultural devastation that to this day Chevron has not paid for a cent for what they have damaged. So we're working to everything that you're seeing now, industrial extraction from oil drilling, mining, mega dams. This is what we want to stop. Amazon Watch is working to stop the destruction, and we're working to advance and support indigenous people's solutions, including protecting their living forests and going to international bodies like the UNFCCC. And we're going to the IUCN and saying, you know, shouldn't there be another category of protection? There's protected areas, there's national parks, there's reserves, there's wilderness areas. Shouldn't there be an area for sacred places? And so the IUCN last year, over 9,000 members voted to support a new resolution at the IUCN, which is the world-renowned, you know, Union of Conservation of Nature. They voted to support Motion 26, which was to say, protect sacred natural areas, keep them free from industrial extraction. And sacred natural areas could include, or do include, indigenous people's territories. So now we feel that that's another tool in the toolbox where we can go to governments, we can go to corporations and say, the IUCN members voted on this. And you know, even governments and ministers of the environment voted on this. And we think this is something that we should implement. This is a way that we can protect indigenous territories. We can protect sacred places. And that will protect the Amazon rainforest, which is one of the places, of course, you know, I would say this, that the Amazon rainforest is one of those places that we should protect in our proposals to protect half of nature around the world. And I did want to talk a little bit for one more minute about our connection to both the destruction and the protection of the Amazon rainforest, because many of the threats, you know, to the Amazon, in particular the Western Amazon, many of the threats are due to industrial extraction, oil drilling and mining, and in particular oil drilling in the Amazon. It's still occurring. What you saw with Chevron and Texaco, it's still happening. And if governments and corporations continue to get their way, they will drill till the very last drop. We can't do that. Global scientists have said we need to keep 2/3 of fossil fuels in the ground if we are to survive a global climate crisis. So we think the Amazon and the Arctic and everywhere, the oceans. But the Amazon, the most biodiverse place on the planet, should be the last place we should be drilling for oil. It should be the highest, it should be at the top of the list for conservation. And so that is our priority, to make sure that the Amazon is one of the places that remains protected and free from industrial extraction. And we need to be promoting renewables, and we need to say, you know, what already happened, we need to fix, we need to restore, we need to, you know, shift to renewable energy, but we do not want any more expanded because we need to protect the primary rainforest, the sacred territories. And the connection to us is that most of the oil that is exported from the Amazon is coming to California. And so we've been contacting companies about their use of Amazon crude. We've been contacting the state, and we have launched a campaign called End Amazon Crude. And we've released reports about it. We've engaged with the companies, and we've also started digging into the finances. So many of you know there's also a massive divestment movement. And so we've done some research on who's paying for this. Who's investing in these Chinese oil companies and these state oil companies and these private companies? Who's investing in? And we found out that JP Morgan Chase and BlackRock are the biggest investors in the oil companies who are causing the destruction of the Amazon. So we put out a report and we're going to be going to their shareholder meetings, and we need your support to do that. And we also recently, just last week, launched a campaign to encourage Amazon.com, which is a company which delivers lots of packages using Amazon crude. So we say, you know, because your name is Amazon.com, it would be great if you could actually invest in, stop using the Amazon crude and invest in protecting the Amazon. So we haven't heard back from them yet, so we're going to need your help with that too. Do we have a couple minutes to show a video?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to stop this. You're going to show, because it's going to end us in a very positive note, and I think we need that for these times. There we go.
The Amazon Basin is the world's largest tropical rainforest, an area the size of the continental United States, or if you could imagine the face of the full moon.
The ecosystem of the Amazon could stop functioning. All of that water vapor that's lifted up by the trees is creating rainfall for all the world. The Amazon is the heart pump of our global weather system. Without the Amazon, we cannot survive this global climate crisis.
Amazon Watch functions as the megaphone for indigenous communities on the front lines. The way we try to connect people through social media is to show the reality of those lives, the messages that they bring, and how an individual so far away can connect directly to someone fighting those fights. One photo can actually move a million people to act.
It's the culture of the indigenous people that have created a way of life that will sustain the Amazon, and we should be learning from them.
Los pueblos indígenas sabemos cómo vivir en armonía con nuestra madre tierra. Porque entendemos de que es necesario mantener el equilibrio. Con tu apoyo, vamos a continuar luchando y defendiendo a nuestra madre tierra, a los recursos naturales, pero también a la cultura, a la pervivencia de nuestros pueblos ancestrales del mundo.
My children will be able to breathe air and survive on the planet only if campaigns today prevent massive deforestation and resource extraction across the Amazon basin.
Our generation is the one who has to act, and act now. If we don't do this, there's nobody that will do it.
Indigenous peoples are now the most important voices to be listened to. Through our work and commitment, we have proven that Amazon Watch is your best bet to defending the Amazon.
It is a critical, critical time for the Amazon. Scientists are saying that 50% could be deforested or degraded by 2020. If we're scared about what's happening right now with climate change, imagine the ecosystem of the Amazon collapsing. We can go another path. Stop business as usual. Stop the dams. Stop the oil and gas mining. You have to permanently protect the indigenous ancestral territories. Together, we can make a lot of change.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Why Protect Half the Planet and Where to Start, with Cyril Cormos, Executive Director, Wild Heritage, Leila Salazar-Lopez, Executive Director, Amazon Watch, Dominic Della Sala, President and Chief Scientist, Geos Institute. It's time for our audience questions, and we have some really wonderful questions. Here's one of the first ones. What are your opinions on population growth? The 2 billion new people in the world need places to live, as do our beautiful biodiversity needs a place to call home. Does population need to be restricted? How? And livestock, it looks like. What regulations need to be placed? So I will start with you.
So one of the things people don't keep track of very carefully but are starting to pay more attention to now is the amount of degraded land and cleared land that's just sitting there, in essence. And we've been talking about the tropics mainly, but there's about 1 billion hectares of forest that's been degraded that could recover. There's about 500 million hectares of land that's been cleared that's lying fallow. So we're not actually running out of space right now. That's not the problem. Yes, there will be need for agricultural intensification in some places. Yes, we need to change our consumption patterns urgently. We need to stop eating beef in anywhere near the quantities that we're eating it right now. And we need to be smarter about what we use for decking and for plywood, you know, and for wood chips, you know. So there's a tremendous amount of slack in the system. We do need to change our behavior patterns, but we're not running out of space. That's not actually the problem. 2 billion people behaving as we're behaving now, yeah, we're not going to survive. Not anywhere near the way we live currently. But there's a lot of slack in the system.
We actually have a number of questions, so why don't we go forward and then we can always come back. Dominic, maybe you would like this one. How do you propose balancing the need for jobs and economic growth with sustainability? Can climate options support this growth and how?
What a great question. Right up there with the population question. So you guys are really on to this tonight. I think that this particular question, every single society around the planet faces this challenge. Can we get there, and how quickly can we get there? And can we do it in a socially just way? I think we can. I don't think we're even close to being a sustainable society. And the more we cut into our planet's resources, as you've seen from the talks tonight, the more we expand our population, the bigger the challenge is going to get. And the Earth is responding in the way it's changing our climate. I think we can get there. I think we can have a focus on ecologically based restoration, which can produce jobs. Let's put the forest back together instead of taking them apart. And let's take out some of the roads. That will produce jobs. Let's put the fish back in the streams. Let's put wildlife back out on the landscape. These are all great ideas that conservation groups all around the world are working on with their communities. There's a whole rewilding effort going on in Europe right now. Europe lost their forest 10,000 years ago, and they're starting to rewild their landscapes. It's really hard to do when you don't have the primary forest as a blueprint, but I think that's there's a jobs component there. We've got to shift from extraction-based industries to being more in harmony in a steady state economy that's locked in with nature instead of fighting nature.
Can I add to that one? Yeah. One of the climate scientists from Brazil, Antonio Nobre, he talks about the flying rivers of the Amazon, and he talks about the need to protect the Amazon, and what it's going to take is, yes, everything we can to stop deforestation and everything we can to restore the forests. And it really struck me the way he said that, you know, when during war, you know, we put all of our energy, all of our resources to fight war. Why couldn't we do that? Why can't we have a new deal? Why can't we have a new deal for the climate, a new deal for the planet, a new deal for the Amazon that puts everyone to work to protect our planet, our only planet that we have? And what if, in our country, I think it's a big, big, big what if, and it's up to the people. But, if we dedicated as much resources as we do in times of war, we could do it, and we need to do it. And it needs to be just. And so that's why the communities that we work with are working towards a just transition for renewable energy and clean energy, clean renewable energy that will and is creating jobs.
I got one more thing to add to that. We have to be careful about the commodification of nature, but I think there's a way to work on leveling the economic playing field for conservation and restoration, and I think carbon is one way to do it. And we need to start valuing carbon and start to develop a trade and cap system for carbon that involves forests, so that landowners that are wanting to set aside their private lands, that are wanting to extend their timber rotations, are getting economic value out of that, not just deriving economic value from the extraction, but the conservation. And that comes in the form of carbon offsets, which this state is a leader in nationwide.
Cyril, let's go to our next question. We have a number of questions, and I will save the cards for our panel because you might want to come up and talk to them when our program is over. But wonderful questions, and thank you to everyone in the audience. What can be done to preserve sovereignty in biodiverse areas such as Africa and even Canada when countries and companies engage in the new colonialism by buying and controlling entire bioregions?
Yeah, I got the easy one. So one of the, you know, this gets back to the issue of indigenous conservation. I mean, you know, there are countries where the corporate presence combined with, you know, government support is so strong that achieving conservation is extremely difficult. Indonesia is an example where you know, it's been very difficult to stop degradation and deforestation in parks. And there's been strong institutional support for palm oil in a lot of the wrong places. So there are some instances where there's not much you can do in the face of corruption and, you know, partnerships between some of these large corporate interests and government entities. That said, there are many examples where working with local communities can make an enormous difference. And I'll go back to the example of the Kayapo Territory. 13 million hectares spanning the Xingu River Basin in Brazil. That area has about 10,000 people living on it. And as you could see from the slide, the level of intactness is very, very high. And that is largely a result of a strong commitment by the community, supported by a number of NGOs working along, you know, the periphery of that area with those communities, basically just to give them the support they need for what they want. You know, whether it's a new radio or an outboard motor or, you know, fighting fires or whatever it is, you know, a satellite dish, healthcare. But NGOs have played a fundamentally important role in supporting those communities, and the result is that very, very large areas can be protected. Now, that model works less well in places like Africa, where the indigenous, you know, community is not as clearly defined as it is in the Amazon basin. So that doesn't always work. But it can work, and where it doesn't work in terms of an indigenous, you know, defined unit, it can still work in terms of a community defined unit. You know, it's a never say die situation. It's not an easy situation when you've got a very, very powerful partnership like that working against conservation, and that's why we've lost quite a few battles. Since I've got the mic. As usual, I forgot, you know, the best answer to give and remembered it 5 minutes after the question was asked. But here's an example of the slack in the system. I live in Berkeley. They're doing a really nice thing in Berkeley, which is they're putting in little parklets on streets. They're taking out 2-3 parking spaces, filling it in, and putting benches and tables out there. I went to Solano Avenue. I saw a new parklet being built. It's a lovely spot. People are going to take their Pete's coffee out in the street. And I saw that there was a proud panel advertising for the fact that they had built it out of sustainable ipe, which is Brazilian hardwood. So there's no way in the world that Brazilian hardwood was sustainably harvested and much less brought from the Amazon to Berkeley, California in a sustainable way. It was very well intentioned. It's called sustainable because it was harvested with best practices, but it's still not sustainable. It was sold at Home Depot. Somebody bought it and thought they were doing the right thing. There's no reason in the world why we need Brazilian hardwoods, you know, for a park bench in Berkeley. So, there's a lot of waste and a lot of ways to come at these problems. Sorry for monopolizing the mic.
Here is a short question. Did Canada's Supreme Court return the crowned lands back to First Nations people? Does anyone know the answer to that one? Is there anyone in the audience who knows the answer to that?
I heard a year or two ago that the last prime minister who was anti-environment was almost crying because he had been trying to extract as much as he could, and all of a sudden their Supreme Court had said, Indigenous peoples, we've never signed the treaties with you. You actually own all of your land. So it's something I think would be valuable to look into in this dealing with Native peoples, because I also know that some of the Chinese are ready to work with Indigenous people to extract it. So it was an interesting, it's like all the U.S. Forest Service land, which is what they call their crown land, going back. So
So have any of you heard about the Great Bear Rainforest Victory Campaign? Well, that is an example of, a massive area that was threatened by timber concessions on the west coast of Canada and Vancouver. Over a decade long, at least a decade long battle, Indigenous peoples, NGOs, government basically formed a multi-stakeholder coalition to permanently protect the Great Bear Rainforest, and where Indigenous people's sovereignty to live on their own land and manage their own land was respected. And, the timber companies got, they got a deal of it. The government got a deal, but not everyone was perfectly happy, but it was an example of, I can't remember the exact number of hectares that was protected, but a massive area was protected. And we're actually looking at that as an example, because, to protect areas like the Amazon and to protect huge Indigenous peoples' territories, we need to look at proposals for protected areas, Indigenous-led protection in the Amazon.
Half Earth is actually working in the Great Bear because they have 84% of that region has some form of protection, depending on how you define protection. There's also ecosystem-based management occurring in there, which is very experimental, removal of the trees. So we didn't get the whole system protected, but we at least met the at least 50% target. It's probably, somewhere in the ballpark of enough to prevent the kinds of extinctions that we've been talking about.
You've been listening to Leila Salazar-Lopez and Dominic Della Sala, and a member of our audience to address this question, and we thank our Commonwealth Club member. Unfortunately, are we on?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we've come to that point in time when we only have one question left, even though we have a number of questions that the audience has had. So again, I encourage you to talk to our panel discussion and among ourselves before we have time to close down the fort, so to speak, and stay for just a little bit. This is our final question that we can ask at the moment. No roads in the forest means that humans have a minimal contact. How do and how can the billions of people on the planet connect to nature and health, I think, to care for it without roads, without destroying nature? Cyril, we'll start with you and ask each member to give their observation.
Well, the answer is very short. We've got plenty of roads. We don't need more. We have enough roads and to get to just about any place we need. If you can't get there, take a boat. That's also an option. But just the projected 25 million kilometers of roads that are planned with this new infrastructure funding that the G20 announced would take us around the planet 600 times. And most of that development is slated for the developing countries in the south and the tropics. So it's just the roads, we don't need more of them at all. So I don't think it's a problem.
Okay, let me bring it into the U.S. perspective now. So many of you probably heard of the U.S. Roadless Area Conservation Initiative. And I was at the signing ceremony in 2000 when President Clinton put that together, protected one-third of our national forest that are roadless, greater than 2,000 acres. Sorry about the acres, hectares thing going on here, but greater than 2,000 acres. But what about the rest of the forest? So the U.S. Forest Service operates and maintains about 420 or 440,000 miles of roads. That's enough to circumnavigate the globe 24 times. That's just the U.S. Forest Service. That doesn't include all the other land ownerships in the U.S. So while I agree we need to have access to nature to love it, we've got to be careful about loving her to death.
And that was Dominic Dalla Sala. And Lila, would you like to comment?
Sure. I will just say that, we've all hopefully been to Yosemite National Park. It is a dichotomy of like really wanting to be there and being stuck in a traffic jam in Yosemite. So there is, I would encourage you to go backcountry, get away from the valley, and you'll see plenty of amazing, incredible nature. I did recently hear that Muir Woods was closed to someone else from Marin might know about this, but you can't just go to Muir Woods anymore. You have to like make a reservation, which I think is beautiful in the way that everyone wants to go to Muir Woods, but there's too many people that want to go to Muir Woods. So there is that dichotomy, but we're in Northern California. There's so many other beautiful places to go. And as a mother, I'll go back to being a mother. It is very important that we connect our children to nature as much as possible so that they could be our next caretakers.
Well, thank you, Lala. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Why Protect Half the Planet and Where to Start with Cyril Cormos, Executive Director of Wild Heritage, Leila Salazar-Lopez, Executive Director of Amazon Watch, Dominic Dalla Sala, President and Chief Scientist of Geos Institute. Our thanks to Cyril, Leila, and Dominic. Let's give them a big hand of applause for their very important work. And for all of the information they brought to us tonight, I think it was really a very wonderful session, and I was very pleased with everyone here in the audience and what we were able to learn. And we should give a big hand to the audience here that is here. So let's give us an applause for our audience. And our thanks to our audience, not only here, but on the radio and on the internet. You can find our programs at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org also for multimedia access, watch, listen to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, also audio and video tapes, and free weekly podcasts and archive programs. And look for our upcoming spring 2018 environmental programs. They're on your green sheet that you have next to you. Thursday, March 15th is Solar Energy Project, Kenyan Youth Innovation Centers. It's a very interesting program for March 15th. Monday, April 30th, the Spring 2018 Update. We do this every spring. Report on the Sierra Nevada's drought, rain, rivers, fires, trees, and snowpack. Wednesday, May 9th is Use Solar, Solar Simplified, Power Amplified for International Use. And Wednesday, May 23rd, Sonic Sea Documentary, Our Oceans Are a Symphony. You will get to see parts of Sonic Sea documentary, which has won numerous Emmy Awards. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. And this Commonwealth Club program at our beautiful building at 110 Embarcadero. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.